You're listening to the Jim Inkster Show on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Jim Nichols sitting in for Jim Inkster, taking a well-deserved day off. We're going to cover all our favorite seasons this morning. We're going to cover the political season. We're going to cover the election season. And we're going to cover some football season. We've got some great guests lined up. Charlie Cook, the editor and publisher of the Cook Political Report. Always interesting to get his take on national politics and the landscape this fall for Republicans and Democrats in Washington. And then we've got our Secretary of State joining us in studio, Tom Shedler, who's done an outstanding job putting together the game plan for the elections this fall. He'll be in charge of making sure you get to vote early and only once. And then in the SEC, Herb Vincent, the Associate Commissioner and familiar name and voice to us in Baton Rouge, will join us to talk about the SEC Network. All of that coming up on the Jim Inkster Show, but first, the news. Jim Nichols sitting in for Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge Public Radio. Our guest today, Charlie Cook, the editor and publisher of the Cook Political Report. And then later on, we'll talk to Tom Shedler, the Secretary of State of Louisiana. It's election season. He's getting ready to put on a statewide election. We'll talk about the preparations for that and qualifying, which is coming up, I guess, in about a week. They'll be coming through the Secretary's office to file their papers, and we'll find out who is really running and who's not. And we'll talk to Tom Shedler about election preparation. And we'll close out the show with a familiar name and a familiar voice to all of us, Herb Vincent. He's over at the Southeastern Conference now. He was at LSU for a long time. And we'll talk about the SEC Network, which launched last night and will change really the landscape for a lot of sporting fans in Louisiana who watch, of course, a lot of LSU, but also watch a lot of SEC. Herb will give us an update on how that's going. But we start out with Charlie Cook. And Charlie, are you with us? Nope. We're waiting for Charlie to call in. In the meantime, we do have the Secretary of State in with us, and we'll talk to Tom this morning. Tom, thanks for being with us.
Jim, pleasure to be here, and look forward to our discussion forthcoming here.
Well, we were going to have you in the second segment, but we're waiting for Charlie. So in the meantime, let's start sure. with talking about qualifying.
Okay.
We all talk in politics about, you know, who's running for this and who's running for that, and are they going to be a good – then the qualifying. Then
right.
we find out who's really running.
All
right?
the talk is over.
All the talk yeah. is over.
All the talk
so
is over.
So when candidates qualify for office in Louisiana, which ones have to come to your office and which ones can go to the courthouse?
Great question. We do all the major elections. Obviously, U.S. Senate would be with us. All your congressional seats are with us. Associated Justice, Supreme Court, Public Service Commission, and Appeal Court judges.
Okay.
And then your smaller offices will go to your local clerks of court. Those are your school board members, various local offices, JPs, and those types of offices go there.
So we got Charlie Cook now. So
well, let's go ahead and do that.
Charlie, and look, Charlie, love to hear from you as well, so we may co-host.
Love to.
Show.
Saw Charlie in Baltimore at my national association recently.
All right, let's get him on. Charlie Cook, are you with us, Charlie?
I am absolutely with you.
Great.
Hey, guys.
Great. This is Jim Nichols sitting in for Jim Inkster, WRKF Public Radio in Baton Rouge, 89.3. And in studio with us, and he may jump in with a question, is our Secretary of State, Tom Shedler, who just saw you. Tom, you just saw
That's him? Correct. Up in Baltimore. Hello, Charlie. How you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm doing terrific.
Well, he said you did a fantastic job, and of course, that's why we have you on this morning. Charlie's the editor and publisher of the Cook Political Report, and he's a political analyst for National Journal. Of course, we see him on Meet the Press and all the Sunday morning programs. He's a Louisiana native who has gone on to prominence as probably the top political prognosticator in the country. And before we get into what it looks like this fall, let's not assume everybody knows who you are, Charlie. A quick maybe 15, 20 seconds on the Cook Political Report, how it came about, and what you're up to nowadays.
Oh, wow. Okay, grew up in Shreveport, graduated from Captain Shreve, worked in Bennett Johnston's first race in 1972, and went up to go to college at Georgetown and worked in Johnston's office and sort of banged around politics for a few years as a pollster and a political consulting firm on the Hill, and then started the Cook Political Report 30 years ago in 1984. And started writing some columns after that, and first in Roll Call, then National Journal. And now I've got a five-person team, and we have a lot of fun watching House, Senate races, to a lesser extent, governor's races, and national politics.
So every indication this fall is it's going to be a good fall for the Republicans. I mean, they're headed for a lot of wins. I don't think anybody would deny that, and I would think we can assume that the House holds and the Senate is definitely in play for the Republicans. But I've been reading lately, Charlie, some are saying that it could be even worse for the Democrats if it were not for the overall lack of popularity of all parties in Washington. Is this a tidal wave fall coming up for the Republicans? And if it's not, is it because folks are just displeased with both parties?
Well, I mean, there is the Democratic Party has terrible favorable and unfavorable ratings, and the Republican Party has worse. And I guess what I'd say to a Republican friend would be, you know, the bad news is that people don't like the Republican Party. The good news is this election isn't about you. That elections are almost never a referendum on the party that's out of power. The only exception I can think of, where really it was 1998, that midterm election that was ended up being a referendum on impeachment, and rather than a tough election for Democrats as it could have been. But the reason we're just not expecting a whole lot to happen in the House, which is why, I mean, I don't think it's going to be a tidal wave for Republicans, because for technical reasons in the House of Representatives, you know, one of the iron laws of politics is you can't lose a seat that you don't have. And because Democrats lost 63 seats in 2010, you know, the most that either party's lost in any election since 1948, any midterm since 1938, and they only got 8 back in 2012, they can't lose them because they already lost them. So in the House, we're just seeing we're seeing Republicans pick up some seats, but not that many. I mean, because, you know, 96% of all the Democrats in the House are sitting in districts that Obama carried. So the House, not much happening. But the Senate, and the Senate, I think there's about a 60% chance that the Senate flips over into Republican hands, but not so much because there's a tidal wave, but just that that this is a map that just really favors Republicans in a big way. Republicans need a net gain of 6 seats, and they could pick up 6 Democratic seats just in states that Romney won by 14 points or more. And, you know, you show me a state that a guy that loses an election nationally by 4 points but wins that state by 14, and that's a pretty tough state for a Democrat to win. So to me, I think Republicans are favored to get a majority in the Senate, but not because there's a huge wave, but primarily because this particular map, the geography of 2014, really, really favors Republicans, as well as the fact that it's a midterm election. And midterm elections, the electorates tend to be older, whiter, more conservative, more Republican than in presidential years that are sort of big and broad and diverse and looks like the country.
So this president is in the second half of his second term, and that's normally not good news for any incumbent president when his party is up in congressional races. But what puzzles me is this economy has rebounded. I mean, most people would say, look, the economy's doing better. Housing sales are up, unemployment's down, consumer confidence is up, retail spending is up. I mean, folks are feeling better about the economy, and normally that directly ties to a president's approval rating. Not the case with President Obama. Can you explain this dynamic where folks are feeling better about their economic future and their prospects? They're buying houses, they're spending money at the retail outlets, but the president's numbers continue to lag behind the economic recovery. Why?
Well, Jim, I think there are two explanations for that. I think you're right. People are feeling better, but they don't feel good. That you've got 50% of Americans believe we're still in a recession. It was actually at 58% back in February. That you look at consumer confidence, and while consumer confidence, yes, it's higher than it's been since the beginning of the recession, but reach back, look 20, 30 years before that, it's still at relatively low levels. And so people feel better about the economy, but they still don't feel good. They're not even at the sort of normal watermark for where consumer confidence is. The second thing is that voters in midterm elections, they have a habit, if they're really unhappy, they vote to punish the party of the president. Mm-hmm. And if they're happy, they vote on other things. So they're willing to punish, but they rarely reward. So to be honest, I don't think the economy is any help at all for Democrats here. It's not as bad as it would what would have been, you know, this time last year or 2 or 3 years ago, but it's not good enough to actually help them.
Our guest for five more minutes, Charlie Cook, the editor and publisher of the Cook Political Report, talking about the prospects for both parties in the fall's elections. Top five Senate races folks should be watching. Just want to rattle some states and some names.
Yeah. I'd say the Republicans are get three Democratic seats just off the top in South Dakota, Montana, and West Virginia, and then they've got, I'd say, 40% or better chances in Alaska, Arkansas, Louisiana, North Carolina, and Michigan and Iowa. So they've got seven Democratic seats where Republicans have, say, 50-50 chances, give or take 10%. And then there are two Republican seats that are in danger, Mitch McConnell in Kentucky and an open seat in Georgia. So you sort of mix all that together, and, you know, you're going to have five or six races that are going to be determined by a point or two, and so this thing could go either way. But with the dynamics that we have right now, the level of exposure, the kinds of people that turn out in midterm elections, I think you've got to give Republicans a bit of an edge in terms of getting the majority.
So we talk about Republicans having a good fall and having potentially the majority in both chambers, but there is also the future presidential elections. That, as good as it looks for Republicans in both houses of Congress, what does the electoral map look like for Republican presidential candidates? Is there a juggernaut there that they may not be able to break for some time?
Well, there used to be what they called a Republican lock on the Electoral College when they won five out of six. And then that lock got picked by Bill Clinton in 92 and 96. And then Democrats won the popular vote, but not the electoral vote in 2000. And then obviously won in 2008-12. You know, we are seeing some shifts, but we're talking about some small shifts taking place. But, you know, for Republicans to, it's one thing to win in midterm elections, because midterm elections each year, at least in the Senate, you have a different assortment of races and states that are up. But for Republicans, you know, historically they ought to be able to win the presidency in 2016. After all, after 8 years of one party, we almost always flip over. But Republicans have got to fix some of their problems with minority voters, young voters, women voters, moderate voters. They've got some real problems that are holding them back, so that to be able to win in some of these really key states like Ohio and Pennsylvania, Florida, they're not, you know, those states weren't as close as they should. I mean, Republicans, you know, or put it differently, the day after Mitt Romney clearly won the first debate last time, he was ahead in exactly one swing state, North Carolina, and was tied in Florida, and was behind in every single other one. So Republicans have some problems, some challenges in swing states that they've got to deal with if they're going to win the presidency in 2016.
Our guest is Charlie Cook. We have about a minute left with Charlie, and I've got to ask you, we've seen a lot of media bought here and a lot of money spent in our U.S. Senate race. We can estimate $40 to $50 million when it's all said and done. Ballpark, what will be spent both by independent expenditure and by campaigns and by political parties on U.S. Senate races in the United States this fall?
Oh, Lord. I've got folks on board that would know that number, but I don't know off the top of my head. But I would say this, that there is a law of diminishing returns in advertising, in campaign spending in general, but specifically in advertising. And once you've seen 200 ads banging the heck out of a candidate, I'm not sure the next 50 or 100 make a whole lot of difference. And that, you know, the smart campaigns are the ones that are not only doing saturation television advertising, but they're doing other things as well, because people just get numb. And, you know, you get it within a couple of weeks of an election.
Yeah.
Given the magnitude of advertising in a lot of these races, people have pretty much hit the mute button.
Charlie, thanks for joining us on the Jim Inkster Show. Best
Thank
wishes
you,
this fall, and we'll talk to you again before Election Day.
Absolutely.
Jim Nichols
Bye-bye.
Sitting in for Jim Inkster on 89.3 WRKF. Coming up after the break, the Secretary of State, Tom Shedler. Welcome back to the Jim Inkster Show. Jim Nichols sitting in for Jim Inkster, taking a well-deserved day off. And we just heard from Charlie Cook, and the Secretary of State is now with us, Secretary of State Tom Shedler. And we're old friends. I'm going to call you Tom.
Yep, absolutely appropriate.
Charlie's interesting.
You call me a lot of other names, too, Jim. And I respond to all of them.
No, it's good to have you. Tom Shedler was elected by the people of Louisiana for a four-year term as Secretary of State in 2011. But previous to that, he was the first Assistant Secretary of State for 3 years and has spent a lot of time and a lot of effort in improving and streamlining the processes at the Secretary of State's office. And one of the duties of the Secretary of State in Louisiana is to conduct our elections. And he does it on a shoestring. It's not a whole lot of money put towards elections, but they're the most important part of our democratic process. And we are in election season. And we were talking before Charlie got on about qualifying. And when you and I talked about it, qualifying is when you put up or shut up. You're going to run, then come put your name in. And we talked about who has to come to your office. When is qualifying in the state of Louisiana?
Qualifying opens next Wednesday, August 20th, and it runs to 4:30 on August 22nd, that Friday. So at 4:30 on August 22nd, we're going to know the field and all of our races, both locally and statewide. And so that's when the gun goes off, so to speak. We immediately get to work. There's a challenge period after that, but we are starting to build the ballots at that point. It's a very tight process. And, of course, being a federal election, we've got to get overseas ballots to our military and overseas voters, which is a very definitive time. We've got to get that 45 days before the election, and Department of Justice is on us the next day to give them a list of folks we haven't complied with that.
So some folks go to the Secretary of State's office. Some folks go to their local courthouse, and the law delineates who has to come by your place. I'm curious, these Senate candidates, these candidates for major office like Congress, do they call your office and say, hey, Tom, I'm coming Thursday?
Some do. We've already received a call from Senator Landrieu and some of the congressional candidates, and they're using notify media, and we give media opportunities in our lobby after they qualify.
Okay, so I'm a political geek. I'm going to ask geeky questions. Okay. Do you have to come in person? Let's say and not that she would do it, but let's say Senator Landrieu was in Washington and it was qualifying and she had votes, or Congressman Cassidy for that matter.
She can send an agent on her behalf to do so. Of course, in person is the preferable way, but you can do it by certified mail, by agent representing you, and you can even
fax.
If you're overseas. Let's say a military personnel wants to run for public office, they could potentially do that. That's the least used method, but absolutely we have agents that come in and qualify for individuals many times.
Our guest is Tom Shedler, the Secretary of State. We're getting ready for elections this fall in Louisiana. How difficult is it, do you think, for the state of Louisiana to be what we call an off-year state? I mean, most states, everybody's running, right? The governor, the U.S. senator, the city council.
Right.
Is there more efficiencies in that regard, and would you like to see us go in that direction?
I mean, I have always been touting for years. We have too many elections in Louisiana. It's very costly to us to run all those elections. But, we do it. We've been doing it that way for years. So I guess even it's right or wrong, you get into a groove or something. But we do fine with it. I'd like to see a little bit more consolidation of elections. But our system is not really set up for that.
So everybody qualifies next week. And then election dates are?
Election dates are November 4th and December 6th. The first one being the primary. And I want to remind people it's kind of something I want to correct legislatively. On November 6th, the polls open at 6, close at 8. On the general election on the Saturday, the runoff, assumably, would be on December 6th, but the polls open at 6, not 7. Okay. That, we changed that law, Jim, and I hate it because it's too confusing.
Okay, so
state election.
Okay, so on Tuesday, November 4th, you can start voting at what time?
At 6 a.m.
And you go till
8 a.m. I mean 8 p.m. Excuse me.
And then on the December runoff date,
you open at 7 and you close at 8.
Wow.
And that is very confusing to the voter. We're going to try to do as best we can to alert people. But, we changed that. We took an hour off that in the morning for state elections. But on the federal election, they did not change it. The legislature refused to do it. I'm going to go back to them and say, look, it's way too confusing for the voter. We need to be consistent across the board.
Early voting. You can vote early. I remember when I was growing up, you really could only absentee vote, as they called it, if you had a legitimate reason. Now, you can early vote.
Wide open. Right? 2 weeks, out from an election, we start and we run a 7-day period at your Register of Voters office or some or other designated areas in the Baton Rouge area here. Of course, the archives, the state archives in front of my office is available. So the interesting thing there, Jim, is that it is becoming more and more popular to early vote, but it's not increasing total voter percentage of voting. Wow. It's just more people are shifting from the voting day to early voting.
The same group is essentially voting. They're just choosing when to vote.
It's moving for convenience, and that's the purpose of it.
And voting by mail, you talked about the military. If I were to go out of town or anticipate mm-hmm. I would be out of town, didn't early vote, do I have the option of voting by mail?
Absolutely. And again, very, very flexible, unlike it used to be many years ago. It's dominantly used by individuals overseas, military, and if someone works for Exxon Oil in France or wherever it may mm-hmm. be, obviously they're voting by mail.
These elections aren't cheap. What does it cost to conduct a statewide election in Louisiana?
Roughly,
what will we pay on November 4th?
Roughly $6
million. $6
million. $6 million. It runs, and I'll tell you a quick analysis of that. $1,250 per precinct is the number we use, and that gets you inside of about 3 or 4% of the total cost. That's commissioner charge, building the ballot, printing, drayage to bring those machines to their location and the like.
Jim Nichols sitting in for Jim Inkster. Our guest is the Secretary of State, Tom Shedler. He and his team are getting ready to conduct a statewide election just a few months away. And, of course, they'll be receiving people into their office next week to qualify. And so we thought it'd be a good idea to kind of go through the old election calendar. We talked about how much they cost. And how do we pay for these elections? Where do you get the money for the
elections? Well, the state pays 50%, and then the local government, those entities that are involved, whether it be a city or a school board or a Mosquito district or whatever, splits the other half in their proportionate share.
And machines, are we completely updated on our machines in Louisiana?
Jim,
I know where I vote, they're sophisticated touch screens.
We have,
is that the case everywhere?
That's the case everywhere. The uniqueness in Louisiana, very proud of it. We have a consistent system, a top-down. We have a machine for early voting that you register a voter, which almost comes in a suitcase with pop-up legs, and then a little bit heavier machine for voting day, but certainly a lot more efficient than what we used to have with those two-ton machines that the infamous picture with Fox McKithen loading the machine on the back of a truck that was 3 feet taller than him.
Jim Nichols sitting in for Jim Inkster. Tom Shedler, our Secretary of State, we're talking about the upcoming elections. Your role in the elections, give me an idea of what Election Day is like for you.
Hectic. And really, aside from Election Day, Jim, just the lead up, you know, as soon as that bell goes off next week with qualifying, we do not stop because it's building the ballot. We're waiting for contestment periods, for challenges, and getting machines ready. Getting draymen ready, getting commissioners ready, delivery of the actual cartridges that go in those machines and laptops to each clerk of court across the state. So it doesn't stop, and it doesn't stop at 8 o'clock on election night. Right. Obviously, we've got cleanup work. So it's about a 90-day process, 75-day process, nonstop. And when you compound that with our earlier conversation of too many elections, so to speak, you can see it's a constant flow, not on a statewide basis, but in certain jurisdictions.
Okay, so it's election night, and I'm home, and I've got my laptop out, and I'm on your website, and I'm hitting refresh every 10 seconds because I want to see the latest election results. Is there any method or rules or laws that require these clerks? How do you get the election returns from the very, and I assume they come by parish, right? I mean, you don't get them by precinct. You get all of Orleans at one time, or you get all of Jefferson at one time, or you get all of Caddo. Is that how it works?
Well, they'll filter in as they come in from the field, because what a lot of people don't realize, that commissioner in charge will take those cartridges out after that poll closes, bring it to the clerk, and then they're inputted. And as they are inputted, Jim, they come to us, and that's why you'll see Orleans Parish, you know, 500 precincts out of 600. Mm-hmm. So it is a time-consuming process, but one that is getting much more efficient. You know, we used to have elections go 1, 2 a.m. in the morning, and the outcome still was unknown. We are pretty much by 9:30, unless we've got a problem with a mechanical issue with a machine or computer lines, we pretty much call on elections or have our elections complete, or at least 90-95%.
Okay, so one of my pet peeves, I'm going to get it out
right
now.
I know where you're going
with
this,
Jimbo. You know where I'm going with this, because you and I have talked about this for years. It is perceived by most and promoted by many that you must have a photo ID to vote in the election. And that is not the case. If I were out shopping with my wife and she goes, oh, let's go vote, and I don't have my wallet, which, by the way, when we shop, I always have my wallet. She never has hers. But we're heading to the precinct, right? And I go, oh, my goodness, I don't have my ID. I can still vote. And
absolutely.
Tell me how I can
absolutely
vote.
You go to your precinct, which you know where it is, assumably under that scenario. You give your name, Jim Nickel. They look you up in the poll book. They see there's a Jim Nickel at ABC Main Street. And you ask some identifying questions, usually mother's maiden name, Social Security. They look at that. You sign an affidavit. You go vote.
Okay.
And to be quite honest, we probably have the best middle road approach. I know some folks that I'll leave on name that are adamantly against photo ID, but the comment made, and these are politicos, that if you're going to have one, though, have one like Louisiana, because it is a fair process. No one is denied the right to vote. We do audit those affidavits, but quite frankly, my audits have not proven any fraud or any abuse.
So we encourage people to bring an ID. It makes the process quicker. It's
quicker.
Easier on our commissioners. It's easier on the people on the line behind you.
That is correct.
But it's not
correct.
The law that you have to have the ID.
That's right. You know, the big thing with the presidential commission that President Obama just recently concluded is wait times and big elections, and you're absolutely right. It shortens it and makes it more efficient for those people behind you.
Not the best segue to the next question, but I'm going to ask it. Louisiana has historically been, and not recently, and certainly not under your tenure or the previous Secretary of State's recently, been somewhat of the butt of jokes of our elections and, hey, vote early, vote often, ha-ha. Speak to the integrity of our elections and
Jim,
how you feel
thank
about
you.
Them.
Thank you for that question. Pew Foundation, who does a barometer in all the states, has just moved Louisiana up to number 18. And I will proudly tell you that we always usually categorize those southern states, Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, Florida. The Pew Foundation is literally saying to me now that you have removed yourself from the southern pack, so to speak. You are now competing with everyone in the country. And I will tell you that my peers, you know, I'm the president-elect for the National Association of Secretary of State. And, you know, we had that great phone app, that Go Vote, G-E-A-U-X, we won a national award on. And I've had 7 or 8 of my colleagues now that are emulating that. I've had several that have visited the state. And I will tell you, most secretaries of state around the country are astounded of where Louisiana is. You know, we're still fighting that perception from years and years ago, but the state of Louisiana today is in the election world, which is a limited world, very well respected, and we just don't have a lot of the problems other states have.
Our guest on the Jim Inkster Show, Jim Nickel, sitting in for Jim Inkster, is Tom Shedler. He's the Secretary of State, and he conducts all of our elections, and that's not all the Secretary of State's office does, and I want to get to that in a minute, but we are in the election season. What do you see on the horizon for elections? I mean, we have evolved over time. These machines have gotten more sophisticated. You've gotten early voting down to a science now. Do you ever see in your career or on the horizon people being able to vote on the internet? Do states allow that? How do you maintain integrity?
I haven't seen any states yet doing that. Now, that, I would never say never to that because, Jim, as you know, that world of computer and IT changes so rapidly that who knows what we'd be able to do. I mean, the technology is there. I think it's more the security issue and the hacking issue that we're more concerned with. But I will tell you that in the area of voting machines, just to give you an example, those machines now are getting about 12, 15 years old. They probably have about another 4, 5, 6 year life. There were federal dollars that were used to buy those. But the precinct of the future will be pretty much like an iPad on a pedestal. And that phone that you just had, that phone app that I told you, where you can go in and see how you registered, get alerted to an upcoming vote, follow election results. You also can mock vote on your phone now. And you'll be able to take that phone, pass it onto that iPad if you want to go in an express line. It'll record your vote. You see it. If you want to change it, you can. It'll print out a ballot for you. How you voted, you double check it again and it goes in a box. So we'll drop down the cost of a voting machine, which now costs $5,200, down to less than $300. So you can see as we look forward, now that is not tomorrow. Right. We're talking out 5 or 6 years. We'll do that probably over a 2 or 3 year period to buy those machines for cost and training, because we have to train a whole new generation of commissioners. So bottom line is there's a lot of things that are going to be happening there. The big question is the one you opened with Will it come in my tenure as Secretary of State? Probably not, but certainly down the road, I think that's probably what's going to happen.
Tom Shedler, just a couple more minutes with you, and that's a great segue into the next question I had. And let's talk about these commissioners. Let's talk about these men and women who get to these precincts before the sun comes up, and they stay well past when the sun goes down. And I know they're doing it for the money, because it's got to be, it's got to be a big time.
Yeah, it's a big time.
But seriously, the same people have been at mine for years. I think so much of these people. Tell me, how much do they get paid? And
$200. They get $200 a day, and the commissioner charge gets $300 a day. And it is a long. We have the longest voting day, only tied by New York State. These typically elderly folks, as you just depicted, show up, you know, 30, 45 minutes before, so 5:15 in the morning, and they don't usually get home till 9. It's a long day for anybody, especially someone in their 70s.
Is it against the law to bring them donuts?
Well, we don't encourage it, but I'll kind of turn my head.
Speaking of the law, I wanted you to speak to this, and I don't think many of our listeners are familiar with this, but you have a unique statewide office. You're the Secretary of State, but our state laws make it clear, unlike the Lieutenant Governor, the Attorney General, the Governor, anyone else, your political status. What can you and what can you not do politically?
Jim, I am totally prohibited from getting involved in anyone else's election other than my own. I mean, I can't be an honorary host. I can't even, not even,
you can't endorse candidates.
I shouldn't write a check. I can't go to a fundraiser. And that's very difficult, because you may have friends that have supported you for years and years, and you have to say, I'm sorry, Jim, sorry, Susie, I just can't do it.
Do you like it, though? Do you think it's a good idea?
I think it is. I'm the chief elections officer, and I think you would, let's say you're running and you're my longtime friend and supporter, as you have been. Let's suppose you win by one vote. The perception there is going to be Shedler did something, or that person did something to make that one vote happen. I can't really, but obviously, you'd be a hard time convincing people. So it's better that you don't. It keeps it cleaner. It keeps it above board, and I don't have a problem with it.
Not much time left, but we talked about elections a lot today on the program. Tell me a little bit, real quickly, what else does – I mean, the Secretary of State
Let me say this. The biggest thing we do is commercial filings. As you know, we have – just like we had Go Vote, we have Go Biz, G-E-A-U-X. And I will tell you, light years, we now do 78% of our business online. It used to be you had to come to my office or put a postage stamp. And in February of next year, we will unveil the first actual one-stop shop. When you come to me, you will automatically be filed with Department of Revenue and Workforce Commission. You won't have to go see those folks like you do now. It'll be streamlined. And I have to give my hat off to both those secretaries, Ballfield and Kurt Isaac, of the cooperation they've given me. But it is going to truly be state-of-the-art, and we'll be the third state in the country to do that. So we're very proud of it.
Tom Shedler, the Secretary of State of the state of Louisiana, he'll be in charge of our elections this fall. You'll see a lot of them next week as folks come through his office to qualify. And we look forward to having you back. Maybe we'll do it again right before Election Day, because there's a lot of important nuances, the hours of change and things of that nature.
Yes, they have.
We thank you for being with us.
Thank you for the opportunity. Thank you.
We'll be back with Herb Vincent, the Assistant Commissioner of the Southeastern Conference. We'll talk about the SEC Network and football on WRKF 89.3 in Baton Rouge. Welcome back to WRKF 89.3 Public Radio in Baton Rouge. Jim Nichols sitting in for Jim Inkster. We had Charlie Cook on at the beginning of the program talking about the election season, the campaign season. Then we had our Secretary of State, Tom Shedler, walk us through the upcoming events, the qualifying, and, of course, then we have our elections in November and December. But it's fall, almost. It's almost kind of fall-like this morning in Baton Rouge. There's a nice, crisp feel to the air. And, of course, besides elections, the most important season is football season. And joining us today on the program, Herb Vincent, a familiar name and a familiar voice. All of us in Baton Rouge and who follow LSU are familiar with who Herb is. He spent a lot of time at LSU, a tremendous impact on the flagship university as their primary public relations officer. He supervised the Sports Information Office, and Herb has a long and great history with LSU. But like any great talent, he gets hired away, and the Southeastern Conference said, you know what, Herb Vincent would be a pretty good associate commissioner of communications. We're launching a new SEC network, and so they stole him from LSU, and he's joining us on the Jim Inkster Show today. Herb, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you guys doing?
We're doing well, and of course, you're at the Southeastern Conference now. You're very involved in the launch of the SEC Network. It launched yesterday at 5 o'clock. You want to give us an update? Are y'all pleased with the early results and the launch of the network?
Yeah, we're very pleased. You know, there's a little bit of anxiety going into the day, not knowing how things are going to go. Somebody, when I got there, somebody from ESPN asked me, what are you worried about? And I said, you know, I don't know what to worry about because we've never done this before. but it went well. You know, going into yesterday, we felt like the network was already a success to some level because we had carriers in making the network available to more than 90 million homes, and some, including the CEO of Walt Disney, have characterized that as the most successful launch of any cable network in cable television history. And that's not just sports, that's any network. So that's pretty big words from a pretty knowledgeable source. but then going into yesterday, you know, you never know what's going to happen. And as a matter of fact, Justin Conley, who runs the SEC Network, kind of said to us the day before, he said, I really can't get anybody to tell me exactly how it turns on. And so there was some trepidation going into it, but it all went well. You know, the show, I hope people got a chance to watch the show last night. We had a three-hour debut of what we call SEC Now, which is our version of ESPN Sports Center. And during that show, we went live from 15 locations, conducted 40 interviews, including 14 head coaches, had a live look in on a exhibition soccer game that was going on, and covered at least 12 of our 21 sports in some form or fashion with interviews and features. So all in all, it was a very successful day, we feel.
Herb Vincent joining us on the Jim Inkster Show. He's the Associate Commissioner of the Southeastern Conference, in charge of communications, and we're talking about the launch of the SEC Network. Help us kind of clarify for our listeners the role of ESPN and the role of who owns the SEC Network and who produces the SEC Network.
Well, it's a collaboration of the Southeastern Conference and ESPN. ESPN is producing it, but we've got a what we call a content committee made up of presidents, chancellors, ADs, senior women administrators, SEC conference representatives on one side and ESPN representatives on the other side that kind of oversee the network. I wouldn't call it a board of directors, but it's kind of like that. You know, the major decisions pass through that content committee. And so that's how the overall philosophy and direction of the network is set through that. ESPN produces it. They're the ones that actually hire the talent, you know, man the cameras, and execute it. Now the other part of the production comes from the campuses themselves, the 14 institutions. For instance, there at LSU, they've invested a certain amount of money into their production facility to get it up to ESPN broadcast standards, where they can actually produce events there, just like they have been in the Go Zone on their website. Now they'll produce it for ESPN for the digital platform. So the production is handled by ESPN, but much of the production is actually handled on each of the individual campuses.
So the SEC owns the network and contracts with ESPN to produce the content.
Well, it's a collaboration of the two. We've never gone into real details about how that contract is structured, but it's a collaboration of ESPN and SEC. And the benefit of that is that ESPN and the SEC are two of the most powerful brands in all the college sports. So you put those two together, and I think you can see why the distributors have chosen to carry this network.
So will the SEC Network have exclusive rights to all SEC sports content? In other words, we have seen in the past, and we don't need to name who it is, but in the past there have been other productions of LSU football repeats on Monday night. There's been baseball games carried when they weren't carried by ESPN or by a major network. All of that goes away?
Well, it goes away from those platforms, but it transitions over to the SEC Network. There will be changes in viewing habits. For instance, there won't be a weekly replay of an LSU football game. That does go away. But there will be replays in the SEC Network, some of which will be LSU games, specifically for LSU fans. So it'll be a change in viewing habits. But, you know, a lot of people ask me a lot about baseball, for instance, because all the baseball games have been on the either in the Go Zone or on your local regional sports cable system, and that will now transition to the SEC Network. Some of those games will be live on linear television, which linear television is what you watch when you're sitting in your living room, but much of it will be on the digital network, the digital platform. those will be produced by LSU, by the campuses, and put on the digital platform, so you'll be able to watch it on your mobile devices, whether it's an iPhone or iPad or your laptop. So those games will still be available to you.
Okay, so I'm 52 years old. I'll admit it, I'm pretty good with the iPhone, pretty good with the iPad, and very good with the laptop. Tell me how to transition, because I think it's very exciting. I mean, I think what the SEC is doing here is paying attention to what the future holds. And I know I have three daughters, and look, they do everything on their phone. I mean, they watch movies, they watch, you know, news shows. And so we will be able to watch SEC events on our phones.
You will. If you get it at home, if your cable system has it, it'll be what's called authenticated on your, let's just use an iPad, for instance. It'll be authenticated on your iPad. You get the Watch ESPN app, which many people already have, and you go in there and you can watch, you can click on the SEC Network. And if you're doing it for the first time, it'll ask you for your name and password, which is provided by your cable provider. And once you're in, you're in. And so any other time, you can just click in and watch a game and see it. And so, and anything else on the network, whether it's features or nightly shows, it'll all be on your iPad, iPhone, whatever your digital, your device is that you carry around with you. You'll be able to see it on the digital platform.
Our guest is Herb Vincent. He's the Associate Commissioner for the Southeastern Conference, and a familiar name and a familiar voice to all of us in Baton Rouge through his service at LSU. And now he's over at the big conference office. I was noticing, Herb, that the conference office is in Birmingham, but is the SEC Network located in North Carolina?
It's in Charlotte, North Carolina. Okay. One of the reasons for that is ESPN already had a studio there. That's where ESPNU is located. It's broadcast out of Charlotte. And so while some of the other conference networks chose to build out an entire facility, which is a considerable expense, our partnership with ESPN afforded us the opportunity to just expand their facility there. It gives us the opportunity to share resources with ESPN and ESPNU. And so that's why it's based in Charlotte.
Herb, not switching total on these gears, but I've got to ask you about, you've been around college athletics all of your life, and a respected voice on that subject. We talk about, we hear about these super conferences and some of the changes with the NCAA. Tell me what you think college football, college athletics looks like 10 years from now.
That's a really good question. I think a lot of that's going to be decided in the next couple of years, because we're going through a real evolutionary and transition period in college sports. We had, as you referred to, the what we call autonomy was granted to the five biggest conferences, where they could make rules on their own pertaining to very specific areas pertaining to the student athletes. There's some misconception that the five have gone off on their own. They're going to just do their own thing. There's just very specific areas that they can make their own decisions. And so what happens the next few years, that autonomy was just granted, I think, a week and a half ago. So as the commissioner says, now it's time to get to work. We've been talking about it a long time. Now we really have to do something. So I can't predict what it's going to look like in 10 years, because so much changes. You had the O'Bannon decision come down last week. You know, that's another transitional type of event in college sports. And so it's an exciting time, but, you know, college sports is always transitioning. It's always changed. It's always evolving. And that's what kind of makes it exciting. So we'll have to see where it is in 10 years. I wish I could give you that answer, but I'll talk to you in 10 years and let you know.
Deal. We'll have you back in 10 years. So the SEC Network, back on that subject, schools are spending a lot of money to be part of this network. Auburn, some estimates, $5 million. Ole Miss, who had some infrastructure in place already, mostly spent money, about $750,000, it's reported, on fiber optics. How do these schools reap back those investments?
Well, you know, the key was for it's going to come out of revenue distribution off of the network, just as the SEC has distributed money from its existing television contracts. Then the revenue generated from the SEC network will just be distributed evenly among the schools, and so each school will get its investment back through the distribution of the SEC network and the revenues off of that. You know, every school had a different investment to make. ESPN outlined some minimum broadcast standards to meet to be able to go on the digital platform and even on linear television. And some schools were well ahead of others. LSU, fortunately, was well ahead of others in this area. Some have a lot of catching up to do. So when you see a story about that and you see various amounts of investment at different schools, it's where they were in the first place. And plus a lot of this, some of this equipment has to do with investment in big video boards in your stadiums, in the production of coaches' shows. Sometimes at some of these schools, this equipment also serves those purposes as well. So, yeah, there's been a big investment on the part of the schools. It's varied depending on where they were in their production capabilities going into this project.
So this year is the first year we'll be heading to a full-fledged playoff system in college football. And as I've said a couple of times already in the program, you've been around this industry, as I would call it, for a long time. Your thoughts about the playoffs, do you like them?
You know, I didn't think I would. If you asked me 10 years ago, like you just asked me a 10-year question, I would have told you no. I think, as I said, college athletics evolves and college football evolves. I think it's time for this. Yeah, I guess maybe one day we'll go to 8 games. I hope not. I hope we stay at 4. I think this is good because there's so many teams that have been close, you know, 1 through 4 that could have played for a national championship. Number 5 is going to be very upset that didn't get in. But if you go to 8, number 9 is going to be very upset. You see in the basketball tournament. I hope it stays at 4 because I think we need to maintain the integrity of the regular season. And we've seen too many times over the last few years that, you know, a Thursday night game between South Florida and, you know, Central Florida had a major impact on the ultimate decision in the national championship race. And you just don't want to lose that mid-season impact of a game. That's what makes college football so great is every game really means something in the regular season. And you don't want to lose that. And if you expand, I think if you expand the playoff too much, you're going to lose some of that impact of the regular season. I think we've seen some of that in college basketball.
Jim Nichols sitting in for Jim Inkster, taking a well-deserved day off. And our guest, Herb Vincent, the Associate Commissioner of the Southeastern Conference. Just a couple of minutes left with Herb talking about the playoffs. Is there any rule or anything out there that would prevent the Southeastern Conference from having more than one team in that playoff? Could it possibly be 2 SEC teams in that 4-game playoff, 3 SEC teams?
It could be 2, it could be 3. It's whatever the committee decides are the top 4 teams. Now, what hadn't been determined is what are those metrics that determine that? And a lot of it's going to be the decision of the committee, just like it is with the basketball tournament and the basketball committee. So it's going to be up to them on who those top 4 teams are, and they could really come from anywhere.
Certainly don't want to date you, but you've been around Tiger Stadium a long time, and while you're not here right now, you grew up around Tiger Stadium. Have you seen the latest improvements to Tiger Stadium, and if you have, your impressions?
Oh, it's unbelievable. It's awesome. I saw it slowly go up. I made my wife and daughter were still living in Baton Rouge. The last year they finally moved to Birmingham. I didn't know if they were coming or not, but they finally moved here on end of June. And so I made a lot of trips back during the course of the year and saw it go up. And it looks fantastic. And then I've seen a lot of the – since then, I think they gave a tour to the media here a few weeks ago when I saw saw it online. And I think they've just done a fabulous job. I can't wait to see it. I don't know which game I'm going back for this year, but I can't wait to see it because it looks like it's monstrous. It looks like it's what LSU deserves. So it's a great improvement for Tiger Stadium.
Well, that was going to be my next question was when do you plan to come to Baton Rouge to a game? Have you picked a game? And I'm wondering if it's the Alabama game.
No, I hadn't picked a game yet. It depends on – everybody wants to go to the Alabama game. So there's a lot of fighting to go to the LSU-Alabama game. We have something here in the SEC office called the Command Center. It's like a man cave on steroids. It's got a ton of TVs. And the commissioner sits in there every Saturday with the supervisor of officials and his assistant, and then either myself or Chuck Dunlap from our staff, or Sean Cartel is another one of our communication staff. We monitor social media, and we see what's going on around the league the entire day. The purpose of that is if there's a problem, we try to address it in real time on that day, whether it's an interpretation of a rule, whether it's a correction, whether the case may be, so that it doesn't go through 3 or 4 news cycles going into Monday and everybody's debating, hey, what happened on that play at the goal line and so on. We can address it in real time. That's the purpose of the Command Center. So I spend a lot of time there, and I haven't determined yet which games I'm traveling to.
Herb Vincent, the Associate Commissioner of the Southeastern Conference, our guest on the Jim Inkster Show, talking about the SEC Network and the upcoming football season. Okay, I got to ask, it looks like to me, from all the print material that I've seen and watching the network launch last night, that the official colors of the SEC Network are purple and gold. Is that your influence as the associate commissioner?
We do. We changed the colors to purple and gold when I got here. I just thought LSU fans would like that a little bit better. And no, they're blue and gold. And sometimes
blue.
They
okay.
appear.
Okay.
But Booger McFarland was wearing a purple and gold tie last night. He was getting a lot of flack from Greg McElroy about that, but he did have a purple and gold tie on last night.
Some familiar faces from Louisiana as we wrap up. Booger McFarland, Marcus Spears, Kylie Hartung. Yeah, all Baton Rouge and LSU fans and friends that will be on the SEC Network. Our guest, Herb Vincent, the Associate Commissioner of the Southeastern Conference and a longtime friend of LSU. Herb, we look forward to seeing you this season and look forward to having you back on the Jim Inkster Show.
Jim, thanks for having me on. Talk to you soon.
Podcasts of the Jim Inkster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Inkster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.